a shot in the dark, wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 267 on Wednesday of intensive class week. Yesterday's show was a casualty of intensive week. Coffee break. Hold on. It was a casualty, if you will. But no, it was a good thing though. I ended up having to take Dr. Michael Tarrion, and it's not often you get to take a brilliant saint to the airport. I love Michael Tarrion so much. Anyway, so I took Dr. Tarrion out to the airport and got to continue a conversation with him all the way there, which was spectacular. But he needed a ride, and he's a good friend of mine, and it wasn't going to make him take an Uber all the way to the airport from down this far south. So I decided to do a rerun. And so you helped me take care of someone. Doesn't that feel good? Do you feel good about that? All right. So more fun with an intensive week. So last night, and if you're just now listening, so I run a coffee house inside of a graduate school, and the graduate school has this week where all these people come to get class in a week. So there's a whole bunch of extra people on campus, and it's really, really busy and very different than the rest of the time. And so things get weird when I'm trying to record over the course of my day job, taking up all of my time. So last night, I went to dinner with Pia De Seleni, who you can hear an interview with on the previous episode of Les Contrapositions. And so we decided to go get some Thai food because evidently all the good Thai food where she is has like tons of MSG in it, and she can't do the whole MSG thing. And so we went to Thai Pot Cafe here in Denver, Colorado, which I've been hearing really good things about, and wasn't sure how it was going to work out, but it was really good. I mean, I was expecting it to be like better than Thai Monkey Club because everybody says it is. I like Thai Monkey Club mostly because it's right by my house and it's really good. It was good. It was really good. It was delicious. I can't say that I would drive all the way over there instead of going to my local Thai restaurant though. So anyway, so there's the Denver Thai restaurant review for you evidently. P and I were stuck in traffic because I decided to go the back way, assuming that the 25 was rough. Turns out there was like a wreck on the 25 and everyone had the same idea. So we were like in stupid traffic on side streets, trying to just get out of the Denver Tech Center. So we finally get there, but along the way, something interesting happened. So we were talking about all this travel that both of us have been doing, and she mentioned something about New York, and I'm like, why don't you go to New York? And she's like, this weekend. And I'm like, I'm going to be in New York this weekend. What are you leaving? Friday. What are you leaving? Friday. We're on two different flights, though. But we're both going to New York. We're both staying almost identically at the same time. And we're staying in hotels a few blocks from each other. So me and Jim Laurent and the lovely and talented Katie Heil from Tatanga Bomoy and her sister, who I haven't met from what I understand, are going to the New York encounter of Communion and Liberation. So, that is always a blast and a super good time. Making no promises, I am taking the gear with me, hopefully to do some interviews, as I've said before. I got some people on my target list that I want to talk to. We'll see if we can make that happen. No promises, though. It's such an absolute whirlwind when you're in the New York encounter. Pia's their guy. Her husband's like speaking at a conference or something, and she's just going to be in New York for the weekend. So I'm like, well, come to the encounter with us. So I get to hang out with Pia this weekend, which should be a pretty good time. Because Pia knows New York a whole lot better than I do. But ironically, my favorite Thai restaurant in the world is like literally right around the corner from the hotel that Pia's staying in. So I'll get to take her to my favorite Thai restaurant as soon as I can remember what the name of it is. And I know where it's at though. And they have this spicy mukrab which is like mukrab is like this little chunks of pork belly that have been deep fried. They're like real crispy pork belly that you put like in with noodles and stuff. And like, oh my gosh, it's so good. Pork belly, you're my friend. You know, when I went to Austria, I was so excited because I never thought I'd meet a person that likes swine as much as me. And I met an entire people that like pork as much as I do. I mean, it's impressive. You can get pork everywhere. Like you can get pork in the, you can get cured pork, pork sausage. You get all kinds of sausage and a glass of red wine in the hardware store. I'm not kidding. In Trumau, Austria, right outside Vienna, where the ITI is, the International Theological Institute, there's a little village, and they've got this thing called OBI. It's like Home Depot. It's like the same colors, same area. It is Home Depot for all practical purposes. I don't know if it's the same company or if they copied Home Depot. It's Home Depot. But instead of like this little hot dog stand like we have out front, they have this like permanent wooden like little like kiosk built, like you put a little kiosk coffee house in or something. And they just have like 30 kinds of cured meats and like sandwiches and stuff you can get and beers and wine. And it's in like a real glass. And so it's great. So I like walked around helping Ginger Mortensen look for a bracket or something, eating cured pork and drinking a glass of red wine while shopping. Now that is the sign of a superior civilization right there. I don't care what you say. I'm not a giant Europhile, but in as much as that, they're superior qua pork in the hardware store. How's that for a good distinction? That was totally unplanned. My impromptu praise of pork and advertisement for OBI in Trumau, Austria. So, the New York encounter, man, I am so excited about the New York encounter. I went 2 years in a row, but it's been a couple years since I went, and man, it is so amazing. It is so fun. It's just, every time I go, I'm just like, oh gosh, I'm so part that even though I'm the worst Cellini on earth, that I'm kind of like this, kind of involved in some way with this movement. We just attract like the most interesting, thoughtful, mindful people you will ever be around in your life. And, it's like, I was trying to explain, you know, to someone earlier today, what happens at the New York encounter, and a few stories emerged like, so yeah, I mean, basically I said, you take a Catholic conference. Picture you're like Catholic. If you're like a thoughtful, kind of like interesting human being that reads good books and likes, you know, but doesn't like just spend all your time in the Catholic bubble, you know, and then picture you go to a Catholic conference. See, all the stuff that you're at a Catholic conference, you're going, oh gosh, really? Really? Oh, please, come on. Why would they? Yeah, okay, subtract all that. There's none of that. Maybe like one table selling like some cheesy books or something. I mean, there's none of that at this conference. It's like really cool, artful, beautiful stuff all around. You're like torn between all these incredible talks that you're like, these, I can't believe people are mindful and beautiful enough to come up with these topics. So like, I mean, here's a good example. So there was a priest, and I can't remember the guy's name. I'd have to look it up. And he's a Dominican, and he's like some bigwig, like in, he runs some, I can't remember what it is he ran, like either a journal or something. Anyways, he's a big VIP type Dominican guy. And but they always attach him to a parish. And so he's attached to this parish, and that's where he kind of volunteers and spends his time and says a mass and helps out with confession and stays anchored to the pastoral life, right? Well, the town that he happened to be anchored to, the parish he happened to be anchored to, was in Newtown, Connecticut. Right when some kid walked into an elementary school and gunned down a bunch of little kids. And so he was working in that Catholic parish when that happened. And so he was just talking, just telling stories and talking about his experience of this tragedy and the beauty that happened inside this tragedy and the lives of the people and just all this stuff. And just, and it was a completely Christian, completely Catholic, completely religious, in the true sense of the word, way, you know, type of talk, you know, in the right sense of the word. But this would have been something that anybody would have walked in off the street and listened to and been moved by it and drawn, as opposed to someone who just walks in and hears someone just using all the Catholic lingo and talking about all these experiences that no one has unless you're in that culture, you know? It's just that, I guess that's the difference with the New York encounter. There's that, it's that everyone is kind of in that raw engagement with reality, you know? And then this, the moments of beauty that happen in the encounter, like, we were at Tir na n'Og, this little pub that's like next to the old venue, and it's called, means Land of Youth in Gaelic. And we were just having some pints, and there was a little Irish band playing in the corner, and they played The Fields of Athenry, and which is in the songbook for Communion Liberation. It's one of our big songs, and the whole place just broke out into a sing-along song. And this, the band was just like, who the hell are you guys? I mean, just like completely shocked that all these young people were just like knew this old Irish ballad and were singing at the top of their lungs. And then some of these kids went outside, and at the end of the night, I remember we're standing outside and it's super cold and people are standing outside smoking cigarettes. And there's these young Italians, you know, probably like between 18 and 23, 24. And they all kind of huddled up in like a little circle and we're like, what's going on? You know? And it's like, and they just started singing. I think it was like a Bach piece or something. It's just like this beautiful music. They're just singing, and every, this bustling sidewalk in the middle of New York just ground to a halt. And there's like a couple homeless guys, people pulling phones out, filming it. People are like stuck in traffic, rolling their windows down and listening. It was just like this moment of beauty, just spontaneous beauty in the heart of this bustling craziness. And I think that's a good way to describe the New York encounter, as a moment of spontaneous beauty in the middle of an otherwise frantic, harried world. So, let's go to the break. When we get back, I got more up my sleeve. You're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. The only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, so a shout out to the lovely and talented Michael Miley. Michael shot me a text right in the middle of my interview at PA yesterday and was asking me to, or the day before yesterday, asking me to comment on this Meryl Streep political kind of speech she gave. I guess it was the Golden Globes. And I hadn't seen it. I didn't know. I heard that she, like, I'm like, yeah, so why is this a thing, right? I mean, they're always making these statements. And so I went and I watched it. And I caught the better portion last night of Obama's final kind of goodbye speech, which, I mean, has been the longest goodbye in history. I tell you what, this guy has done more goodbyes than, but, you know, like it or not, a good half of this country was like straight up in love with this guy as a president. And of the other half, contrary to popular opinion, there were things that some of us liked about Obama. For starters, I love the idea that we actually elected a black man as president. I know, it's funny. I'm a conservative. I'm supposed to be a hater and be racist, right? The only thing I like about Obama is that he's black, just about. And there's a few other things. But so here's the thing is it, and I kind of watched the reactions to this Streep thing. And then I was kind of listening to the reactions to the Obama speech last night. And I kind of want to throw them together and talk about them. So it seems like, how to say it? There is a certain kind of like, There's a certain unwillingness in political life to acknowledge anything good about your enemy. And any kind of good motive that maybe is misapplied or misunderstood or misdefined, but good. And so starting with Meryl Streep and her commentary, first of all, the fact that she would take it upon herself to give that long of a speech in accepting an award and that they kind of let it go down and all that. It's pretty pretty planned, it wasn't like spontaneous. I mean, she made it look like it was very spontaneous. She is an incredible actor. And so Trump saying she's overrated. No, she's not. She's an incredible actress. She always has been. She's a great actress. Just acknowledge it. You'd be lucky to get someone that famous and that talented to come to your inauguration. I don't like her politics. I don't know her as a human being. I don't know. Right. I'm sure we wouldn't get along for the most part. She'd think I'm some kind of hater or something, but the woman's ridiculously talented as an actress. Now, I will say, though, I think the moment of the night, and it's become a meme all over the place, was when they panned Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn sitting there. I don't know where Vaughn's at on the political spectrum. I know where Mel is. Mel is far to the right. And a little nuts. Okay, a lot nuts. But it's sidebar, I'm kind of pleased that Hollywood has made its peace with Mel Gibson, because Mel Gibson, he's the crazy, drunken, racist, conspiracy theory uncle of Hollywood, but he makes really good films. And I haven't seen Hacksaw Ridge yet, but by all accounts, it's just epic filmmaking. And the guy makes good films, and he needs to be making films. And you need to pray for the dude. Hopefully he'll work through all this anger and alcoholism and demons he's been facing and all this stuff. Vaughn, I don't know anything about it, but Vaughn just did not seem kind of moved. He didn't seem like he was pissed, but he didn't seem moved by the whole thing. But she made the statement that, you know, in this room, there's, you know, the foreign, there's foreigners, press in Hollywood, the three most vilified, victimized people. I'm like, and I'm just like, oh, please, you know. And that she, in her defense, she did talk about her privilege and the absolute privilege of being an actor and getting to do that for a living and work hard doing something she loves and all that. So, I mean, there were things in her speech that I thought was good. Now, I don't know about the whole, I mean, she was ripping on Trump, modeling, kind of like mocking that, that handicap person. And, I don't know. I've heard arguments saying that you can find a whole bunch of times when Donald Trump is making those gestures. And anytime he like wants to talk about someone being an overreactionary spaz, he makes those hand gestures, and he didn't remember that guy being handicapped. That guy had done a pretty in-depth, pretty long interview with him, but you know, he meets a lot of people. I don't care. I've made no qualms about saying that I think that our president, our elect, is a barbarian ass. He's just nice. He does and says things that are not in good taste all the time. I don't think he, but what she talked about was this modeling this from the top that makes it okay. Now, I think that cuts both ways. When there's voices from the top telling people something and kind of giving them permission, I agree with her on that, but I think it cuts both ways. I think definitely Trump speaks in very divisive kind of xenophobic terms in a lot of ways, but the guy tried to run for president with Oprah Winfrey. He tried to get Oprah Winfrey. His daughter converted to Judaism to marry Kushner, his brother-in-law, who by all accounts is the power behind the throne and the guy that orchestrated this whole thing. So it's like, I have a hard time calling someone xenophobic who tried to get a black woman to be his running mate and whose favorite daughter and his most trusted advisor are Jewish. It's like, I don't think he's ideological enough to be a xenophobe, but But when you model the, I mean, she's right in the sense that when you start seeing, when you start modeling the belittling and the dehumanization of certain types of people, then you're kind of giving permission. But I think that Hollywood has done that just as much too. I think Obama has done that with the way he's spoken about racism and the police and about, and it's not standing up to his own community in the black community and holding them to account for, you know, things like, what's the guy's name up in Ferguson? Michael Brown. Is that, was that the guy? The guy robbed a small business owner, carried stolen property down the street. And then when confronted by a legally appointed officer of the common good of the law, turned, and by all, we haven't heard about this much, but look at the autopsy reports. It confirms that he charged him and tried to physically attack said police officer, and he got shot, and they tore a city up and burned a city down over it. And they kind of threw gas on those flames for the sake of their agenda. So I agree with Streep on this sense, but it cuts both ways. You know, when you, now I think that, the Obama speech is a little different ballgame. I thought the speech was great. I disagreed with a few things he said, but I thought overall the speech was great. And I saw a lot of people. It was funny. It was really interesting on the American Solidarity Party Facebook page. There was a lot of reactions, and some people are just like hardcore conservatives, and they're just like, they cannot say anything good about Obama whatsoever. And even if they said, well, he doesn't believe any of that and blah, blah, blah. Even if they disagreed with it, even if they agreed with something, you know, they were just like, I don't want to hear anything out of his face. And, you know, but the other people were like, that was good. Like Mike Maturin, the former candidate for the American Solidarity Party, said, I thought it was a good speech. You know, and it was a good speech. Now, it was a speech that, like all of his campaign speeches, were full of hope, you know, the hope and this and optimism, this daring optimism. Now, the one thing that I thought was really, really amazing, and not amazing, but like, I think it's just a blinding flash of the obvious, but it was interesting that he chose to do this. He kind of, some people said it was a tweak on the Democrat Party in general, but a lot of people read it as kind of a shoving Hillary's nose in it and reminding her that she lost this for everybody. Was he said we can't just, if we continue to frame this as undeserving black people and minorities versus racist, xenophobic, you know, white people, everyone's going to lose. You know, if both sides keep saying these things, if both sides keep looking at each other, and he mentioned the working white man in particular. So I think that the Democrat Party has realized that they have lost, when they lost the Rust Belt or the industrial heartland, as I heard it called the other day, which I want to talk about that, where I got that phrase. He acknowledged that I think they're finally waking up. They lost because they've lost touch with the common man. And I've said this time and time again, the common man out there in flyover country, he's pretty conservative socially. Where I'm from, all those Blue Dog Democrats, they are not, they're not down for all this crazy agenda of the Democratic Party. It's just about the unions, you know? And I want to talk a little bit about that in the next segment. Okay. When I want to talk about, I know you're going to hate this term, that there's a little bit of Trump's genius in what he's done so far already. And I know I can't believe I'm saying that. I think it's probably not his genius. I think it's Kushner or some of his advisors have figured this out and they've just kind of used his instinct to get it out. But I want to talk about that a little bit too, about what's happened in the business world. So anyway, you are listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley, and we'll be right back.
Then how we crave a hanging in its dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, you know, before I move on from this, I want to talk about this. There was an aspect of the speech from Obama last night where he talked about, he kind of put constant change as a traditional part of the American experience and the identity of the American Republic. And it's interesting. I disagree with him in the way that he phrased it. There is a vitality and a solid underlying vision of what life is about and what government is about and what the common good is about, and that does kind of define America, and that doesn't really change. But America can, in fact, change in a very quick way. Now, I think the problem is like since the 1960s, I think we have changed our fundamentals in a way that is contrary to our founding and contrary to our identity as a country and a republic. And I think that he sees that as part of the republic, or he sees that as part of the definition and the vision of America, and I disagree firmly with that. But there is a certain vitality and a certain suppleness to the way we play out these things that I think is interesting. And I got to thinking about, you know, it's like there's an old story about Thomas Merton once said that if you keep one foot firmly rooted in orthodoxy, then you can explore wherever you want with that other foot. You can go to the east. You can look over here at this kind of political theory. You can go where you can go around and look at a lot of different things. You can play with a lot of different things with that other foot, as long as you keep that other foot firmly rooted and grounded in orthodoxy and you don't pick that foot up. You know, you could argue that would be like reading through the hermeneutics of continuity as Ratzinger used to say, Benedict XVI used to say, to go, okay, great. Well, what would this mean we're not going to negotiate on whether or not this is true. This is true. So what would be true about this if this were true? You know, okay, well, all right, okay, we can find, and you can do like St. Paul and sift everything and see what's good, right? And keep it. Now, of course, with Merton, I think that, God love him, he had like a half a toenail kind of still. Nah, it's not true. He had a couple of solid toes, maybe part of a foot. But he was starting to pick that second foot up out of orthodoxy when he got killed in 68. And but it seems like there are these two extremes in the American Republic about this, what stays the same in the nature of change versus you know, in development versus mutation, so to speak, to use kind of the Catholic term and the way we use it. Well, it's a biological term, but we use that in terms of the development of doctrine, right? When something unfolds, it becomes more of itself, right? An acorn and an oak tree look very, very different, but an oak tree is when an acorn continues to die to itself and become more and more of itself, it becomes an oak tree, right? So things can be very different and still be the unfolding of something that is the same, right? But I'm kind of reminded in some ways, I don't know if this is kind of a bad analogy, but I'm going to try it out and see what happens. It's like in ancient Greece, there were these two pre-Socratic philosophers, Parmenides and Heraclitus. Now, Heraclitus thought that everything was flux, and stability or a permanence or any kind of stillness was in fact an illusion. And he said famously that you can never step in the same river twice. And that's what he thought reality was about, was this constant change, constant movement. And the nature of reality was change and movement, and that anything that looked like it stayed the same, that was an illusion. Now, Parmenides was on the other hand. He was the polar opposite. Parmenides said, basically, if y'all want to walk across the room, I have to go halfway across the room. And if I'm going to go halfway across the room, I have to go halfway. And I have to go halfway of halfway, and so I can never go anywhere, basically. All movement, all change is an illusion. Everything is basically stasis. And there is no change, really. Everything stays the same. So Heraclitus said nothing stays the same. Parmenides says everything stays the same. Both of them thought that the other, anything besides what they thought, was illusion. I think that is kind of symbolic of the radical kind of worship of change and worship of movement that we see. And it's admittedly charming and optimistic and good, well-delivered, rhetorically speaking, version last night in the Obama speech. And on the other hand, we have, I'm a constitutional, I'm an originist when it comes to the Constitution, but to act like everything can stay the same, even though life is so incredibly different now that nothing changes and we just always have to go back. It's like, there's one side is like, and if it ain't broke, break it so we can fix it and make it different than it was before. And the other side is kind of like this historical reenactment, kind of almost like LARPing or something, you know, where no, we have to go back. We have to go back. And you see that, you know, in the way some people speak of the American founding, or something. We just live in a very different world. I mean, I definitely want to look to the principles of our founding. But some people want to just kind of, it's what they're going to try to be, like a Little House on the Prairie politically or something. I mean, it's boring to me, and I don't think it works. So I thought that Obama's speech was good. I thought that he actually acknowledged some things that needed to be acknowledged. And I think that if there's anything he has to offer, he offered it last night. The last thing I want to say about this is that when it comes down to, I think that what we have lost, and what I saw with the comments on his speech all over the internet, and even within kind of political world like the American Solidarity Party that I really agree with in their comment thread, is that, it's like if you don't like someone's positions on something and what they do, you have to you have to discount them as a person. You have to hate them or something. You have to just, if you don't like what Obama does, and Obama's a Muslim, and Michelle's a man, and you're communists, and they're all trying to overthrow America and get, blah blah. No, they're not. They've bought it into ideology. He sat under Jeremiah Wright. He was bought into that liberationist theology. He thinks that God is always on the side of the oppressed. He's no different than from Gustavo Gutierrez in that sense, or who was the feminist version of that? Like Sally McFaig, is that her name? Hey, Robert Cohn was a black liberation theologian. I mean, it's like this idea that like it's all about oppression and liberation. God is on the side of the oppressed, so we have to stand up with the oppressed. Right now, the extension of colonization kind of inside of our country is like white people versus everybody else. And he's kind of bought into that agenda to a certain extent, right? But he still cares about good versus evil. He's just wrong. I kind of, as a human being, as best I can tell, I kind of like Barack Obama. If I could sit down and have some Hawaiian food with the dude, or you'd be like Anthony Bourdain and eat a bowl of spicy noodles with him and talk, and off the record just ask him some questions and kind of try to find some common ground and probe a little bit and stuff, we could probably find some stuff we agree on. We could probably figure out where we disagree. Now, on the other hand, I think that Trump's a barbarian ass. Culturally, we are two completely different human beings. I would not even really want to hang out with the guy. I'm kind of disgusted by him. And I actually agree with some of the stuff he's already doing. So I think that he's got, I can acknowledge when he does something well. And I don't have to like the guy to acknowledge that he did something well. I don't have to be glad that he was elected. I don't have to think that he's a good human being. I don't have to think that he means well. I don't know. He's a complex, weird figure. So I don't know anything about any of those things with him. But I'm going to be in the same city as him, most likely. He's probably in New York. So maybe I'll swing by Trump Tower. We'll hang out. We'll have a cappuccino. I'll ask him why he insists on being a barbarian ass. Wouldn't it be better just to be nice and do all this stuff? But, you know, I think that the thing with Trump is that he's the kind of person who is not ideological. Or he was a New York liberal a few years ago. I mean, the Clintons went to his wedding with Melania. I mean, it's like he's not ideological. He suddenly became this big conservative, supposedly. And he's always had positions on economically that were conservative, but I think he's just down to get the deal done. And he saw that what would get the deal done was to treat this like reality TV, whip up the masses. He know who to pit against who to fire up, who to piss off, who to do all that. And he did what it took to get the job done, to get the deal done. Now, what I've said always, and I'll say again, is that if what he has to do to get the deal done, to get something through that he wants through the Congress or something, maybe he'll give him a moderate Supreme Court justice. Even though he promised us a bunch of pro-lifers. I don't think he's ideological enough to keep that promise if he thought it would be important enough to get a deal. So, but I want to talk about what he has done a little bit when we get back, because there's some stuff on that front. So you're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then all the color glass, that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to see. Love bedecked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dumb.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. Yeah, I'm fired up today for some reason. I'm going fast. I think I've just had too much coffee. I was tired. Hold on, let me get a sip here. I was tired this morning, even though I got a decent night's sleep. So I started tanking on the coffee. I think it's kicking in. All right. I can't believe I'm going to use the phrase, but I used it before, so I'm going to say it again. Trump's genius. I can't believe I'm saying that. I don't think it's him. I think Trump is, to a certain extent, a figurehead. I think he's way more calculated than people give him credit for. And I know I've talked about how out of control he is, and he'll fly off the hook and say something stupid on Twitter. And I think there is an aspect where he's uncontrollable in that way. But I think that some of the stuff that's looked very uncontrollable is actually controllable. So over the weekend, I was down in Gallup, New Mexico, and I was in a hotel room, which I told you all about. Red Roof Inn. Cheap. Good. Solid. Stay there. And why I've pumped that on the show a few times. Why? He's like a small business owner. He's a friend of a friend. And the guy just does a good job and just cares about something that other people would just let go because it's a dated motel. But anyway, so this, I had cable news in the hotel room, which I don't have cable news at home. My cable stops at channel 22 on purpose. Plus, you know, like EWTN and like the Create channel, which Jim Ducky Laurent is absolutely addicted to. Pray for him and his Create channel addiction. but I had cable news, and so I kept finding myself, you know, that's why I don't have it, is I will sit and watch cable news. So I was watching Fox News, which I hate and can't stand for the most part. I was flipping through the channel, something caught my eye and I left it on. So I come back and there's the guy's interviewing the head of, like, I guess the American Steelworkers Union in Pittsburgh or something. This guy's like the head of this big steelworker union. And it was pretty fascinating. Here's a guy who's a hardcore union guy, semi-permanent Democrat. And he was just defending Trump all over the place. And remember, I saw coming about a month and a half out that Trump was going to win and that he was going to win the Rust Belt. Because I saw all of my Blue Dog Democrat friends on Facebook posting pro-Trump stuff. And I think that the, and so what was interesting is this, he said something about the Rust Belt, and this this steelworker, the head of the steelworker union, corrected him and said that we don't like that. That's a slur. We prefer the phrase industrial heartland. And that is better. The industrial heartland. Out there where there's the common man and the working man, but he isn't working on a farm. He's working in a factory. They're building something. That used to be a huge aspect of the American experience. And so let's look at what Trump's done. Trump's trade policy, his forecasted business tax policy, and just how, look at what's rallied. Wall Street has set records. Like, I haven't seen the news in a couple of days. I'm not sure if we actually hit 20,000, but it was like it was going to just go all over the top. Set a record. Small business optimism. They just got that metric in. They do every year where they go and they ask thousands and hundreds of thousands of small business owners how they feel about the upcoming year, whether they're going to feel good about expanding, whether they're going to expand, whether they're willing to hire, whether they're willing to risk. And the metric that came back of optimism from small business owner was three times what it normally is, I think. I have to go look that up. But it was like huge. It was bigly up. It was up bigly. And so small business owners are looking at this tax situation. The possibility of some regulation might get off of them. There was an article I read the other day about it's called China Fun. It's a restaurant, local neighborhood, Chinese restaurant in New York. Fairly famous, really solid following. Been there for a long time. I guess they're famous for their soup dumplings. And they shut down. And they cited just the level of regulation, the level of paperwork, and the level, I mean, these chain stores have whole departments. These chain restaurants have whole departments to do this. If you're a small business owner and you have a restaurant in New York City, you have to have someone damn near full time. And I was just doing all their taxes, doing their regulations, doing all this stuff, filing all this stuff. It's like, it's gotten oppressive. And I think that when someone sees someone like Trump come in and say the things they've said, they think, oh, this guy gets it. He's going to get some of these people off our back. He's talking about dropping the business tax rate to 15%. So, and he's also talking hard about, now here's what was fascinating about the steelworker guy. This guy pointed out that the way that Trump has been talking about China and about trade deals and the way he's treating people trying to build stuff in Mexico and bring it back in and all this stuff because they're American, these have been the policies of the major unions all this time, which have been ignored by the Democratic Party. These unions have been anti-NAFTA, anti-trade deficit. They have been begging the government to fix this trade deficit and to renegotiate these trade deals so that they have a chance for American products to actually compete in the global market again, in an American market again. So let's look at what Trump did. This is why I call it genius. He built a completely coherent synergy of policy that he floated out there that he took basically what would make Wall Street feel good about investing, what would make a small business owner feel good about borrowing some money, expanding and hiring some more people, and the hardcore trade positions of Democrat union leaders, and put it together into a set of policy that made all of them happy and made things kind of like already flourish a little bit and happen. I mean, like I said, I will admit when someone does something well and when something works, even if I can't stand that person. And I'm not a fan of Trump as a person. I'm not a fan of a lot of what he said. I'm not a fan of what he's done. This economic side of things, I think he's knocking it out of the park. Now, if he can get this past an increasingly already divided, weird kind of like bad instinct Republican Congress, my gosh, like when they get back together and the first thing they want to do is to kill that ethics committee, that independent ethics committee, even though it's a bipartisan disgruntled with this thing. I mean, the optics on this are idiotic. Why would you do that? Why would you make the first thing that you did look like taking away the people that are keeping you from being able to put your hand in the cookie jar? And it taking a very, very complicated explanation to explain to someone that's not what you're doing. Why would you do that? And then you turn around, you try to repeal Obamacare. And the way you want to do it is by passing this budget, which adds $9 trillion of debt over the next 10 years. $9 trillion. I thought these Republicans were conservatives. And God bless Rand Paul, man. Rand Paul took to the floor like he has on so many occasions and was just the last honest, sane conservative in the room and just took them all to task over their rush to do this. It's just, anyway, so if I was worried about, the Congress being able to restrain this maniac Trump, now with fiscal policy, I'm kind of worried about Trump actually trying to get something good done, and these rhinos and all these idiots on the right getting in his way. I can't believe I'm saying that. That's shocking me right now. And like I said, just like I said before, I don't have to think he's a good human being to say that. I still stick to what I have said during the primaries, or back when he had gotten the nomination, but they were still on the left. It was still up for grabs. I think that Bernie Sanders is the only decent human being in the run. I disagree with him super firmly. I think his vision for the country is wrong. I think he's wrong, wrong, wrong. I actually think he's a decent human being and believes in what he's doing. I think that Hillary was a wannabe tyrant, and I don't know what's going on with Trump, but I'm starting to see that maybe he's crazy. I think he's crazy, but he's crazy like a fox, man. And this guy is, I'm just scared that this deal-making ability, his ability to, this thing that I'm praising, his ability to find the common ground that would make a union leader, a small business owner, and a Wall Street banker all happy and feel good about moving forward, that at some point there's going to be something that I really care about that's in that mix that's going to get short shrift. And I have a feeling it could be the pro-life thing, or it could be religious liberty. And that scares the hell out of me. But at least it'll scare the hell out of me while I'm paying less taxes and while all of my friends who are small business owners can maybe get some regulations off their back. And heaven for, I mean, look, they opened up the Jeep Wagoneer factory again. They're going to do Wagoneers again in Warren, Michigan. They're all this stuff. There's already, he isn't even president yet, and you're seeing manufacturing jobs being recreated again because, in the words of one of the execs, it seems like we have a president coming in that wants a pro-manufacturing, pro-business environment. So anyway, that's my take on the whole thing. So, man, I didn't mean to spend this whole time talking about politics. I don't like when my show turns into that. All right, well, let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counter Position. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for coming out.
I'll take your place, marble stone. I'll take your place, marble stone.